Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's August, and the heat is on the Obama administration. Polls show that more Americans now disapprove of the president's handling of health care than approve of it. New unemployment numbers are due at the end of the week, and an increase is expected. Then there are clunkers, CEO bonuses, health care homework for House Democrats who started their summer vacations last Friday. The Senate leaves the end of this week. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of the ABC blog The Note. Rick, look ahead. This week, President Obama and Vice President Biden will tag team across the country to defend the stimulus bill. Today, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is in Hartford talking not about health care reform, but about health insurance reform, a shift in tactics and terminology.
A critical difference, and I think it fits the strategy that Democrats more broadly are trying to employ right now, which is that they really need an enemy in this fight, and they've decided to make it the insurance industry. They want people to realize that whatever changes that are coming about have a lot to do with taking on the special interests as they see them, and particularly the insurance company. What's interesting is that the insurance company has been largely supportive about the idea for reform, but as they get into the details, they've been a lot more wary, and this signals that that war is being declared on them, that the resistance they've had for things, including the public option, means that no longer are they going to be at the negotiating table. They're really going to be on the other side of the firing line.
Well, because they have been at the negotiating table, they will say they've compromised.
They can, but the key distinction that they will not budge on is the idea of a public option, which is a public entity that would compete with private insurers. Insurance company says this would be devastating to business. That is an absolute non-starter, and it's been something that the left in particular and President Obama included in this say that it has to be part of any kind of reform plan as a robust public option.
How much has the Obama administration failed in getting the message out as to just what that public option is? Because his critics have been able to say it's nationalization. His critics have been able to say the entire health care reform is just about the middle class and wealthy Americans bearing the burden of the uninsured. So how much has he missed getting out that message of how everyone will benefit from reform?
Clearly it hasn't connected, and that's why we're seeing some new messaging as we go into the August recess.
Well, so Democrats have been sent home with these talking point lists. What are the points?
The points are, first of all, the people would not lose their coverage as it is now. But I think the biggest point is that the health insurance industry in the special interests aligned with them have been opposing reform for quite some time. The other side has the ability to fire away at four, soon to be five, different health care plans that the Democrats have. Meanwhile, Democrats haven't coalesced around one plan.
Well, and they also haven't explained how it will be paid for. And you note in the note the appearances of Treasury Secretary Geithner and Chief Economic Advisor Lawrence Summers on the weekend talk shows, they were asked about that.
Tim Geithner was pressed repeatedly to say that he would not, the president would not raise taxes on the middle class. Tim Geithner said, though, that that's just not possible right now, that a broad-based tax hike on the middle class is something that the administration is considering, is something that's on the table, despite what the president said during the campaign.
Let's take a look at some of the issues. The Cash for Clunkers plan, as we well know, last week it ran out of money in the first week. The House voted $2 billion more towards this program that allows Americans to trade in their old clunkers and get money towards a new, more fuel-efficient car. But what's the Senate going to do? And what happens? Is there a possibility the Senate might not pass that? What happens then?
There's a very real possibility the Senate doesn't pass that, and in which case the program will have to be suspended because Congress controls these purse strings. The administration will have no recourse but to say that they're not going to be able to fund this any longer. There's a lot of resistance as well, particularly from Republicans who feel like this is a subsidy to the auto industry that's already being bailed out in multiple different ways, and that this is really not even thinking about the long term.
Well, and we saw numbers today saying that this has positively impacted the car industry, just the 1 week of sales. These are people that already destroyed their cars. Some of these transactions weren't finished. The money goes to the dealership to help them buy the new cars. Where will the anger go if that money isn't voted by the Senate? Will it go to Republicans or to the White House?
I think a lot of it's going to be directed at Republicans if they're seen as obstructing this. The Senate wants to move this quickly. The Senate Democratic leaders say they want to get this done, but Republicans can do a lot of procedural things to slow this. I think it'll be clear who is holding it up and who is not. And I think a lot of the anger will be directed at Washington in general to say, look, you found lots of money to bail out banks and even automakers, but here I am trying to take advantage of a government program, and you're saying that the door is shut on me.
Well, and let's just briefly touch on Wall Street compensation. Last week, the House voted to reform it. Will the Senate agree? And can they disagree, given that we have stories like the Citibank subcontractor, Andrew Hall, who's demanding $100 million in bonuses from Citibank? It's money he made speculating on oil. He was, in fact, partially responsible for driving up the cost of oil last year. But legally, he says he's owed that money. And it would, in essence, be bailout money from Citibank.
That's right. Knowing that Citibank wouldn't be in business in all likelihood if not for the bailout, it is bailout money. There's a limited number of things that the Obama administration can do around this. There is a pay czar who can give approval in advance or disapproval. But as we move further and further away from the beginning of the Obama administration, it's harder for the president and for his administration to say these are things that predate us. They are going to own these things, including these lavish compensation packages. In terms of reining in executive pay, even the sort of modest efforts in the House have not been matched in the Senate so far. It's not clear that even having a shareholder vote, as has been proposed, is something that would prevent these kind of huge payouts that we're seeing right now. But it's going to be a big decision week for the administration in terms of whether to approve these packages.
And again, can the Senate and Republicans in the Senate turn down CEO pay reform with stories like that? Aren't they worried about the backlash?
They will be. And look, they can do whatever they like. And you see lots of areas where there's inefficiency in the government system. There's going to be attempts to water it down. We haven't seen the big populist outrage that we did earlier the year around this one. Maybe it's because people are away for the summer. They're thinking about other things. But as long as there's a little bit less attention on it, then it gives people an opportunity to change what this would mean.
Well, and the Senate will make its decisions before Friday, because that's when their vacation starts. Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of ABC's blog, The Note. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
U.S. troops have pulled back from Iraqi cities, and now Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that the U.S. is considering speeding up its withdrawal from the entire country because violence levels have fallen so dramatically. But 6 people died in bombings in Baghdad and western Iraq over the weekend, and the Iraqi prime minister headed to the self-governed Kurdish region in the north of the country to try to defuse Arab-Kurdish tensions that could make it harder for U.S. troops to leave. And you may remember the memo that surfaced last week from a senior American military advisor in Baghdad who argued it is time for the U.S. to declare victory and go home, lest our presence there cause further resentment. Well, against that backdrop, Major General Kenneth Dowd is orchestrating one of the largest relocations of military hardware and people in recent years. We're told the easy part will be bringing the 130,000 combat troops there now back home. The hard part? Removing beds, tanks, and in some cases, whole McDonald's franchises. Major General Dowd is Director of Logistics for Central Command. He's in Florida. General Dowd, thanks so much for giving us some of your time.
And Robin, very excited to talk to you today.
Well, it was your public affairs officer that told us that of equipment, people, and bases, the 3 things that have to move, people are the easiest. Do you agree with that?
Yes, ma'am. People are the easiest thing to move out of the country.
Well, let's remind everyone, you've got a deadline, at least on paper, to be out of Iraq by the end of 2011. That's 2 years. A year from now, only 30 to 50,000 U.S. military advisors and trainers, non-combat troops, are expected to be in Iraq, down from the 130,000 there now. What are you thinking about this move you have to make?
It's being worked for about 24 months now. It's an overall move that we've looked at to make sure we coordinate it with the war fighters. So as things develop, we have a projected timeline to move folks out.
Well, and I understand towards that goal, you've been doing what are called rock drills, simulations.
Right.
What are those like?
We bring all the senior leaders in to various locations. Our last one was in Kuwait. And we bring the national partners like our Transcom, which does all our mobility, and our Defense Logistic Agency, which does all our logistical from the wholesale level, and lay out the plan on what we are thinking of doing in the next 2 years. For instance, we'll have our truck companies that are located in the south come up to a base camp that's in Iraq that's being reduced. Mm-hmm. and we would pick up the trucks, tanks, those types of equipment, and move them down to Kuwait, and then transload them by ship back to CONUS, and CONUS is the U.S. of A.
Well, now, where is the equipment going? Because some of it is coming here, but not all of it. So where else is it going?
Some of it, with our build in Afghanistan, we have critical types of equipment, engineering, Humvees, those type of things that we need in Afghanistan. So we'll bring them through a refit location in Kuwait, fix them up, get them ready to move, and then push them into Afghanistan.
And what kind of equipment would be left behind?
Right now, we're going through a process of identifying those types of equipment, what we call, you know, like white gear, which we built our base camps with. Those type of things might be donated or sold to the Iraqi folks.
White gear, what's that?
White gear is like something in a base camp, like a building, air conditioner, or some kind of a border thing that we use for force protection. Those could be donated over there. We have a lot of scrap metal that we utilize that came, and we might donate that over there. We have some old containers that are no longer usable for by our military, so we might donate those kind of things. Things that would be found on a base camp that we don't need to bring back to the U.S. of A., but could be utilized by the Iraqis.
And the bases. At one point, there were 275 in Iraq. You've turned over 100 this year alone. You talked about turning over buildings as part of what you're doing, but are you literally moving Iraqis in, or is it Iraqi forces that are going into these bases? What's happening with those buildings?
Some of these bases are physically coming down, and we're moving all the stuff and gear out of there. Some are being transloaded to other locations that the Iraqis may fall in on. So it's kind of like a chessboard right now where they want to set their forces up, might be at one of our base camps, and we might send some of that gear over there to improve that base camp. But part of it's being taken down. Base camps eliminated, and some are for future Iraqi efforts. So that's the kind of way across the board.
Well, and what about the big stuff, tanks? Will some of those be left for the Iraqis as well?
Right now, Robin, we're looking at all those types of things, and we're early on in the planning efforts and looking at what equipment we might sell to the Iraqi military, but no items have been identified specifically.
And we also understand that one of the goals is to store equipment in neighboring Arab countries. First of all, what kind of equipment might that be, and how sensitive do you have to be to how they might feel about that? What kind of political questions do you have to ask in the region?
You know, that's kind of a classified question.
Is it really?
Yeah, I really wouldn't want to go into that. But we do have locations that we've identified in countries where we would store some of this stuff. And, for instance, our MRAP vehicle, that's the new vehicle we have out there, which has a lot of protection on it to go against IEDs and those kind of explosions.
It's the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle.
That's MRAP. That's it. And we might leave a couple of those in the region for future events or future efforts, but we have identified some of those locations within the theater, but I don't want to go and tell you exactly, you know, Robin, exactly where they're at.
Okay, that's Major General Kenneth Dowd, in charge of logistics in the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. When we come back, we'll keep some up at night. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're talking about the planned withdrawal of 130,000 U.S. combat troops from Iraq in 2 years. 31 million items need to be moved. That includes trucks, planes, containers, tons of ammunition. 8,000 convoys will move it. Some of it will be sent back to the U.S. Some will be sent on to Afghanistan. Some will be left for Iraqis. Some, as we just heard, will be stored in neighboring Arab countries whose civilians may or may not be happy about that. The Boston Globe recently reported the operation is so huge that Congress wants more oversight of it. Meantime, military planners are working overtime to get it done, and that's if the situation in Iraq remains relatively stable. Major General Kenneth Dowd is at Central Command in Florida. He's overseeing the logistics of the planned withdrawal. General Dowd, tell us something that you're thinking about having to move that Americans might not be thinking about.
Well, what keeps me awake at night, you know, the tanks and the Bradleys, we have plans for those. We have where we're going to put some of that stuff into Afghanistan. We've got some of that stuff coming back to the U.S. for future deployments. But the big thing I look at is the environment and those type of things and how we're going to leave the country. And we have extensive plans that we've worked on as we close these bases to leave it as much as it looks like when we got there. So we're working the environmental, as I talked about, scrap metal, and making sure we have processes in place either to get rid of it, donate it, or bring it back.
Well, and tell us more about that. Are you talking about, you know, just, you know, old canteens that troops have left behind? You want to make sure it's cleaned up? Or do you actually need to rebuild where, let's say, the U.S. had a huge staging area and took out all the shrubbery? You know, how much do you have to tidy up?
When I talk about tidying up, you know, my concerns is we have large fuel locations that will have to drain those locations, have the environmental guys come in, take a look at that, make sure we're back to the proper environmental requirements, those kinds of things. It's across the board on how you look at as we dissect this, but we've brought our, you know, experts in to take a look at this, and that's a lot of times we spend on these rock drills is looking at the procedures on how we're going to move and get rid of this stuff.
The rock drills are these sort of tabletop exercises where you're mapping out with some of the leaders in the region just how you're going to move everything out.
Exactly. We bring the senior leaders in, and we just talk about what routes and those kinds of things. It's like a rehearsal.
Right. Some of your consideration cost, for instance, if it costs you more to move something than it might actually be worth to buy it new, is that the kind of thing you might give to the Iraqis? I'm thinking of, you know, heavy generators or things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if some of those things, like, for instance, some of our tents that have been sitting down there for a while, environmentally doesn't make sense or cost-wise to bring them back all the way to the States. So we would donate to that to the Iraqis, or on those generators that you talked about, we might sell them at a reduced price, or we might go through our foreign military sales where we could sell them to the Iraqis at a reduced rate. Those are the kinds of avenues we're looking at as we look at the drawdown.
Well, this is fascinating. We understand last year 8,500 containers were shipped out of Umm Qasr, but in the first 2 months of this year alone, 3,000 containers, almost half, have been removed. So you're really stepping up.
We do this every day, and we have really started stepping up on some of this gear that we know we don't need anymore. Let's get it moving now, as you talked about earlier in our conversation, before the big bow wave starts.
So you want to get all this done before the big bow wave. In other words, you know, the bow of a ship coming through. What do you mean by that? Do you mean the ultimate big move in a couple of years, or what do you mean by that?
Well, we have some things going on. The elections are going to take place. We've got some timelines where we see some rather large movements of gear coming out. So we've taken a good look across the board right now, identified some stuff that we no longer need up there, or some of our damaged equipment that's been out there in combat. We're starting to move that out of the country and get it back to CONUS so we can get it into our reset programs where we get it fixed and get it ready for our next event.
A couple questions for you. We've spoken often here to Anthony Cordesman. He's a well-known analyst. And a couple things he points out. He says, first of all, you have to be careful because, again, as you seem to have indicated, you don't want to put a lot of equipment in a neighboring country where someone gets the message that, let's say, they're going to be used as a springboard for an attack on Iran. So you have to be careful of that. But he's also told us in the past that one of the problems of a quick withdrawal is that you become a target. You're a convoy stretching from, you know, Baghdad to Kuwait. Is that something you have to think about, you know, putting so much equipment together in one place as you remove it?
It's always a concern. I follow the lead of the warfighter. For instance, you know, the MNFI commander, as the situation on the ground improves, he makes those kinds of decisions and will move stuff.
This is the International Forces in Iraq leader?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, for instance, if something occurs and we have some more issues in one location, we may hold up and keep some of our forces out there. But I follow the lead of the warfighter, and then we have a couple of plans in there as these things start to occur and peace breaks out and things are going the right way, we'll start to move stuff out of there.
And what if it doesn't? Is that also factored into your thinking that what if a year from now it goes the other way? Hopefully it will not. But if it does, and you...
We've done prudent planning on that, ma'am, taking a look at that. If it does, like you said, go the other way, that's in part of our analysis almost each and every day, looking at the intel, looking at the threat, and we can, you know, respond if something like that occurs.
Yeah. That's Major General Kenneth Dowd. He's got a big job. He's the Director of Logistics for Central Command, which oversees U.S. forces in the Middle East, and he is choreographing the eventual withdrawal of people, equipment, and bases from Iraq. General Dowd, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Hey, ma'am, it's been an honor, and thanks for taking your time.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the man who trained the dolphin known as Flipper has spent years atoning, trying to free captured dolphins. Now, through the gripping new film, The Cove, he's trying to save dolphins from slaughter. That's tomorrow. Still to come today, why German resistance to Hitler was ignored by the West. That's after the latest news, Here and Now. Some students at Bunker Hill Community College here in Boston will be burning the midnight oil this fall, but they won't be doing homework. They'll be in class. Bunker Hill is just one of many community colleges bursting at the seams, in part because of the economy. One of the ways they're responding is by offering two night owl classes starting in September. Mary Fifield is president of Bunker Hill Community College. President Fifield, when will these classes run, from when to when?
Well, these classes will run from 11:45 p.m. at night to 2:30 in the morning.
Yikes. And why did you decide to do this? We've been hearing that more people are choosing community colleges because they can't afford other colleges.
I think in part more people are choosing community colleges as a cost-saving measure. However, I think at the same time, there are so many community colleges that are offering new programs that are in high-demand fields that will enable students to get jobs, and I think that that's an equally attractive feature.
Sure. Someone from your behavioral sciences department is quoted as saying that there are people who are working. They're working all day, and maybe they get up early with their kids as well, and if they're trying to change careers in this economy, the only time for them to go to school is midnight till 2:30 in the morning.
I think that's probably a good point. We're offering Principles of Psychology as one of our midnight courses, and we're also offering College Writing as one of our midnight courses.
Yes.
We anticipate that both of those courses are versatile enough. They will enable students to not only learn something valuable in each of them, but would serve as a very good conduit into a more extensive certificate or degree program.
Right. But as far as the just over-enrollment, how can you express how many students you have enrolled?
Well, I can tell you how I expressed it to the Globe at one point when they asked me. I said, I feel like the old woman who lives in a shoe. If you can imagine a visual to go with that, every single seam has cracked open and there are heads and arms popping out all over.
We understand Bunker Hill operates 7 days a week, classes from 7 in the morning till 10 at night. Now you're adding the new ones. You go around the clock Saturday, Sunday, and still you don't have enough classroom space.
That's correct.
Well, you at all worried that these new night owl courses are going to let students out at 2:30 in the morning? The T here in the Boston area, that's the, you know, public transportation, closes at 1. And even if it didn't, I mean, kids, young adults getting out at 2:30, does that trouble you?
We're anticipating those who will be attracted to these courses are accustomed to working the late shift anyway. They'll be pretty street-savvy individuals.
And what about instructors, people that teach the courses? Did you have to twist arms?
This is not my idea. In fact, it was Professor Reeves who came to me, and he was so frustrated with the lack of space at the college that he wanted to turn it into something positive.
That's Professor John Reeves, chair of your behavioral science department, who suggested this to you.
One of his instructors had approached him and suggested she teach at a off-schedule time. And I think when he asked her what that meant, she said, well, why not midnight?
Well, some people would say, why not online? You know, why not? Did you ever consider that as well?
We've already got 1,500 students online.
What's this?
And so that option's available to anybody who wants it. But, you know, there are folks who work night shifts who, when they get off from work at, let's say, 11, 11:30 p.m., are as wide awake as any of the rest of us might be at 8 in the morning.
What does this tell you about how hungry people are to learn?
I think what it tells me is something more significant from a policy perspective, that this country has still not realized that or acknowledged that everyone should have a right to higher education. And I think President Obama is doing a really good job, certainly most recently with his announcement of $12 billion for community colleges in this country, because these are the institutions that serve those who need education the most and who have it the least.
Because we know Bunker Hill Community College students are, as we said, many of them have families, they already have jobs, they're trying to get ahead.
Some are trying to get ahead, some are simply trying to keep up.
That's Mary Fifield, president of Bunker Hill Community College, which is going to be offering late night, night owl classes starting this fall. President Fifield, thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Go to hereandnow.org. You can click on Contact Us. That'll take you to email and a phone number. You can also scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. We'll be back with the debates over wilderness declarations in the West. Westerners want New Yorkers to butt out in 30 seconds, here and now. A recent editorial in the New York Times has picked at an old wound. The Times was encouraging Congress to pass the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act. The bill, co-sponsored by Representative Carolyn Maloney, a Democrat from New York, would designate more than 20 million acres of the Mountain West as wilderness, meaning no roads, no logging, no off-road vehicles. It has 90 co-sponsors in Congress, but if you look closely, none are from the Rocky Mountain states, which is probably why the bill won't come up for a vote. In fact, first introduced in 1991, the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act has never come up for a vote, and our next guest says it probably never will. Bill Schneider is the outdoor editor at the online magazine NewWest.net. He joins us from Helena, Montana. Bill, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be on your program, Robin.
And we know you've got your own opinions on this, and we want to hear them. But first, in general, just tell us how Westerners feel being scolded by the New York Times about a bill co-sponsored by a New Yorker.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are sort of mystified by the Western attitude towards our national parks and national forests and other public lands. And a lot of people do want wilderness, but they want it done sort of on the Western terms instead of Eastern terms. So when you have a main sponsor of the bill living in the skyscrapers of Manhattan, that just is automatically a roadblock for a lot of people and a lot of Western politicians.
Well, and that's at the heart of this debate. And so just tell us a little more about why people who love and live on the land and feel as if they've been good caretakers would not want the wilderness bill. I mean, just tick through some of the people who are against it and why.
You know, the things that aren't allowed in wilderness, like motorized recreation, snowmobilers, ATVs, and then logging and mining in some cases. Those are the main groups that are opposed to wilderness.
Right. Well, a couple things. You write, first of all, to that perception that these are Easterners telling Westerners what to do, that that's not really true.
Well, that's right. That's totally correct. The bill was put together by local environmental groups here in Montana and Idaho and the other states in the Northern Rockies, and they couldn't find any local politician, either in the House or Senate, that would introduce it. So in order to move forward, they had to go out of our region, you know, which is really kind of a sad commentary.
Well, and to the other point that many people in the New West are understandably a little territorial about the land that they live and work and play on, but you remind them of what exactly wilderness does for the economy out there.
It's been proven many times over that when a wilderness is designated, the local communities benefit from that economically, sometimes directly with the creation of outfitting jobs or other recreation-oriented jobs, but indirectly also people move there. Real estate usually does well in like a an area, resort area, where there's a lot of nearby wilderness. That's why people will move there, sometimes for second homes. They'll move their business there just for the quality of the environment. And that's been proven many times over.
Yeah, you write, do you think people move here or vacation here to see mines, drilling rigs, and stewardship logging? Or elk and bears.
I think if we could really calculate the amount of jobs, the sort of the indirect jobs, that a wilderness area creates, that a vast majority of the people would be in favor of wilderness. Because it's just a lot there. And everybody knows there's a lot, but nobody really can compare it to 300 timber mill jobs that you can look right on a spreadsheet and see. So that's a real big issue for the promoters of wilderness. If they could ever really calculate that accurately, then they would have a much more powerful argument for wilderness.
So you are sort of, in a column I'm looking at anyway, really begging people in the New West to look at what wilderness actually will do for them. And you say, it is the wilderness, stupid. You know, it's good for us. It makes us who we are. Is there something else going on here? Because a lot of the, you say New West, when we hear that, we think that a lot of the traditionally red states in the West are turning blue. And this might be closer to reality than ever before. Is that making it a more personal battle than ever before?
There's definitely a purple tinge developing in states like Montana. I think another big issue, Robin, is the scale of this. A lot of people in the East, I don't think, quite understand the scale of what we're talking about in Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act, which is would designate around 22 million acres of wilderness. That would make it the 40th largest state.
Yeah. It would be as big as Massachusetts.
It'd be four times the size of Massachusetts. And so a lot of this is scale. When you get debates on wilderness, a lot of it is how much, not rather where we should have it, or it's where we should have it as opposed to whether we should have it. And a lot of the debate is on that point.
It would stretch from Idaho and Montana to parts of eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, and western Wyoming. The thinking is that species and plants need an ecosystem, that they don't know boundaries, and they cross over state boundaries because they don't recognize them, so that it has to be that big an area.
Well, that's about what this act is really about, incidentally. The backers of this aren't doing it for recreation or for economic reasons. It's a science-based. That's their attitude.
Yeah.
They think we need this to, you know, preserve wild nature, and it's not an economic or a recreational consideration. And some people obviously don't see it that way. They think the economic and recreational aspects of wilderness are more important,
right?
Hence more debate.
What about some of the piecemeal proposals? Montana Senator John Tester has introduced a wilderness bill of his own. He calls it the Forest Jobs and Recreation Act. It's designed to create 668,000 acres of designated wilderness in Montana, and logging jobs along with that. That's far less, though, than the 20 million acres in NREPA, the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act we've been talking about. What about that piecemeal approach?
John Tester's new bill has a little bit better chance. Both of them have kind of a jobs cover story, if you would want to call it that. In John Tester's case, he put it right in the title of the bill, and he actually has certain acreages that needs to be cut in a couple of national forests, and it's just a little more mandated instead of a little more nebulous.
Where would jobs, by the way, come from in NREPA?
They are going to divert timber receipts into a restoration program, which the backers claim can create as many as 2,300 jobs to restore damage that has been done through past abuse by ATVs or mining or other practices that have been counter to the wilderness ethic. And during the process of restoring that, it would create a lot of direct jobs.
Right. Bill Schneider, outdoor editor at the online magazine newwest.net. Bill, thanks as always.
Well, it was a pleasure being on your program, Robin.
The conventional wisdom about German resistance during the Nazi reign is that there was none, or hardly any, that Germans either walked lockstep or goose-step with Hitler or just didn't know the extent of his evil. But a new book chronicles in exhausting detail the work of a wide network of German artists, intellectuals, and high-ranking bureaucrats who tried in vain to turn Germans against Hitler and turn the Soviets and Americans on to what he was doing. German intelligence called them the Red Orchestra, or Rota Capella. Capella because it literally means chamber orchestra, but it's also the German word for a network of radios, which the resistors used to send messages. And Rota, or Red, because some of them were communists, but they were betrayed by the Soviets during the war and dismissed by the U.S. afterwards. Journalist and playwright Ann Nelson tells the story of the Red Orchestra in her new book, Red Orchestra, The Story of the Berlin Underground and the Circle of Friends Who Resisted Hitler. She joins us from the Argo Network Studios in New York. Ann, welcome.
Thank you.
How did you come to this story?
I was literally taking a walk in Berlin in 1999 and came across an exhibit that was the ruins of the Gestapo headquarters, and I saw these phenomenal faces in photos on the wall, and some of them were from Wisconsin. And they had been executed for opposing Hitler, and I immediately said, who are these people? I had to find out.
Well, one of them, you found out, was Greta Kuckhoff, am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's right.
Who had traveled from her native Germany after World War I to Wisconsin, studied in America. And this group, the Red Orchestra, sort of revolves around her, at least in your telling. Tell us more about Greta.
She was a young German, and she got to Wisconsin and had a great time. She was fascinated by the American Civil Rights Movement and feminism and all of these progressive politics in Wisconsin. She goes back to Germany in 29, and then the Nazis take over. So she immediately faced this tremendous conflict between her values and the society around her.
And her friends were there by her side. They included Arvid Harnack, a German she met in Wisconsin, his wife, Mildred, who came to Germany and became the only American woman executed by Hitler. But that gets us a little ahead in our story. As this group of friends is forming and becoming alarmed as their country is becoming more and more totalitarian and the Nazis rise to power, what did they do?
Well, first of all, these were all people who had connections through academia and the arts with a lot of Jewish friends. And they watched their Jewish friends lose their civil and political rights and become more and more persecuted. So one thing they did was just help them. And they forged documents and pulled together foreign currency, much of it illegal, much of it at great risk of being sent to concentration camps themselves over time. They put out a lot of flyers denouncing the Nazis and tried to get German public opinion to turn against them, but the mechanics were so difficult. They had to do little runs on mimeograph machines of 50 flyers at a time. So here in a country of 60 million, you couldn't get very far with that. And finally, they just decided to infiltrate the Nazi government and work against them from the inside.
And they did. We mentioned Arvid Harnack. He worked for the Economic Ministry. There was also Harro Schulz-Boysen. He was a Luftwaffe intelligence officer. And here's where it was just so difficult to read, that these people who risked their lives to get intelligence from inside the Nazi government tried to get that information to the Soviets in particular, and the Soviets, Stalin, wouldn't believe them.
They also were trying to get the information to the Americans. Arvid Harnack was actually sent by the Nazis to buy aluminum from the Roosevelt administration's government. And he tried to meet with the State Department and say, help me work against Hitler. Well, they sold the aluminum and they wouldn't take the meeting on working against Hitler. This was 1939. A little later, the Soviet intelligence people approached them and said, give us information. And so they tried to alert the Soviets that Hitler was planning to invade.
This was after Stalin and Hitler made a pact, a deal, not to attack each other. So he was trying to tell them, no, Hitler's going to renege on that deal because of intelligence he had. And Stalin just didn't want to hear it.
Yeah, I think Stalin decided that he had outsmarted everyone and he could trust Hitler's word, which was, of course, wrong. And he'd also shot everyone in his intelligence service. So these poor Germans who were trying so hard to build up opposition to the Nazis were caught in the middle.
And it turned out that having contacted the Soviets to try to warn them of Hitler's attack, which came, that became their downfall because Soviet agents were incredibly bumbling in keeping contact with them and, in fact, ultimately revealed who they were.
That's right. After Stalin had blown off their intelligence, the invasion happened, and then they wanted it badly. So they sent a radio transmission to people in Brussels to contact them that included their names and their home addresses and telephone numbers. So the German army intercepted it, and they were just rounded up and arrested and taken to the Gestapo.
Well, and they paid for their work with their lives. At this point, we're not surprised at how brutal it was.
No. There were over 150 arrests in Berlin alone, and over a third of those people were executed. A few committed suicide under arrest to avoid revealing the names of friends under torture. But there are also people who escaped arrest, and I write about this young Jewish art student, Katya Kasella, whom I was able to interview in Berlin 2 years ago.
Just about everyone except the artist that you mentioned and the woman that we began with, who'd spent time in Wisconsin, Greta Kukoff. Everyone else died. So what is the conclusion? They died and no one listened to them.
Yeah, well, the Germans have this term civil courage, and it's a term that means people who stand up to injustice. I think it'll take a long time for intelligence history to parcel out exactly what the various anti-Nazi groups did inside Germany. That research is still becoming available. But you can look at the record and say there were anti-Nazi Germans. There were people who decided to risk their lives and in some cases gave up their lives fighting fascism, fighting Hitler, fighting the Holocaust. And that is important for us to know. Because everybody faces situations that involve injustice, and they say, what do? I'm just a little person. And when you see people who take that decision, it gives you something to work with in your own life.
Mm. We mentioned that the Germans called them the Red Orchestra, but in some ways, was that a misnomer? I mean, how many were communists?
Yeah, the Red Orchestra was the name the Gestapo gave them. And if you look at the group, really a real minority were Communist Party members. They were extremely heterodox politically, ranging from conservative to centrist to leftist to communist, also very mixed in terms of religion, Catholic, Lutheran, and Jewish. So that is something that's taken a long time to correct in terms of the historical record.
Well, it's also one of the reasons we don't know more about these resistors. They may have had only a few communists in their midst, but post-World War II, communists replaced Nazis as the new enemy of the West. Greta, for instance, survived, but she ended up in Soviet East Germany, and the U.S. just wasn't interested in heroic communists.
That's right, but also it was complicated because the East Germans and the Soviets decided in the 60s they wanted to own them. So they suppressed the historical record about the non-communists, and they inflated the record about the communists. And they also removed most of the references to what they did on behalf of persecuted Jews. So at that point, the West Germans and the U.S. said, well, if they're communists, we don't want to know about them. They were really victims of the Cold War as well as the Nazis.
Ann Nelson's book is Red Orchestra, the story of the Berlin Underground and the circle of friends who resisted Hitler. And thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.